If you think you know a bit about family values, you might want to think again. The Bible's idea of a good family is much different from even the happiest homes we know today. I'm Mike Aquilina. Join me and Dr. Scott Hahn as we examine the biblical idea of family and the standard it sets for our homes today. Welcome to First Comes Love, our ongoing conversation about the family, the church, and the Trinity. I'm Mike Aquilina, and it's my great pleasure to welcome back Dr. Scott Hahn, Professor of Scripture and Theology at Franciscan University of Steubenville. Scott, welcome.
Good to be with you again, Mike.
Scott, I always thought I came from a large family. I'm the youngest of seven kids. Both my parents were 47 when I was born. But now I've read your book, and I'm learning that my family wouldn't have even registered as a family in the ancient world.
That's right.
It kind of redefined our idea of the large family here.
I think we have to come to a new understanding of what God really meant when he said in Genesis 1:28, be fruitful and multiply.
All this time I was thinking about adding, right? Right.
You know, ancient Israelite notions of family differ very drastically from modern notions, but mm-hmm. this isn't just something that was true for ancient Israel. In my research, I discovered through years of study that ancient Israel shared with ancient Greece, ancient Rome, India, China, and many, many other societies and civilizations a much deeper, a much broader, a much more beautiful and religious conception of the family than we could understand. Well, I'd like to fall back upon the research of a family sociologist who taught for many years, decades, mm-hmm. at Harvard University. Professor Carl Zimmerman spent a lifetime of research studying families and different civilizations, and he pulled it all together in this massive work entitled Family and Civilization.
You're not going to read that to us.
No. 800 plus pages. I have read it three times, though, and it revolutionized my understanding of the family, even though Zimmerman never focuses upon anything in the Bible or anything about ancient Israel. It's just Greece, Rome, India, China, and some European societies as well in antiquity. What he does, he classifies three different family types. He labels them the trustee family, that's the highest, okay. The middle one is called the domestic, and the lower one is called the atomistic, like the word atomic, A-T-O-M-I-S-T-I-C. Okay. The trustee family is the one that was the newest to me. And what he shows is that in the ancient world, the societies that really blossomed and became civilizations did so because they had an experience, a conception of the family that was much bigger than anything we know in the modern world. He called it the trustee family because the family wasn't defined as all of the members of the household or even all of the living members of the present generation. In ancient civilizations that were based upon the trustee family, he showed that this religious vision of the family defined the family in terms of the ancestors who were, you know, generations before, as well as the descendants who were not yet born.
So it's not just the extended family. It's not just grandma and grandpa and the aunts and uncles and cousins, too.
That's right. It's not just extended out in space, but time. It's a kind of what he even calls a mystical conception. Wow. And he shows how these civilizations not only saw the family as religious, but they saw religion as familistic.
Where does the word trustee come from? I guess that's where I'm.
Yeah, the people who are alive here and now mm-hmm. aren't the family. They don't own the land. They are trustees of this sacred patrimony. The blood in our veins, the name that we bear, the land that we live on is all invested with such sacredness that we see it as a sacred trust, and so we are trustees mm-hmm. of this mystical family corporation. Family worship was central, so the hearth was a sort of altar of sacrifice. The patriarch was a kind of priestly figure. But you also discover that this is not just the patriarchal family, but a matriarchal family as well, because marriage was considered to be sacred. It was a covenant. In fact, he even uses the term sacramentum, this Latin term that captures the sacredness of the marriage bond.
That's where we get the word sacrament, I guess.
That's right. And so in these trustee family civilizations, you had the living members imbued with the sense of a sacred trust that they must preserve and transmit to the next generation and enhance, if possible, but most especially preserve. Now, he points out that these trustee family civilizations would grow. We would look upon them and, you know, think of them as city-states, if not nations, but they thought of themselves as extended families. Again, not just extended in space over hundreds of miles, but in time over hundreds of years. And once again, he doesn't look at ancient Israel this way. He doesn't even consider it. But this is exactly how ancient Israel thought of itself as well. You find this, for instance, in the book of Joshua, chapter 7. When Joshua had to identify the perpetrator of a particular crime, he consulted the priests, who consulted the Lord, and all 12 tribes of Israel were brought before Joshua and the priests. But they were brought before them as a national family. Oh. The 12 tribes were confederated as a kind of national family at Mount Sinai under Moses, and they continued that way under the leadership of Joshua upon entering the Promised Land. And so they were brought tribe by tribe. Yeah. Then the tribe of Judah was selected, and then all of the households or the clans of Judah were brought forward, and one particular house of Zerah was selected, and then the Zerahites were brought forth from Judah, from Israel, and then more specifically, you have one household identified, and then a man, a father, who was actually accused and found guilty. But what it shows us is how natural, it was just kind of a matter-of-fact sort of thing in Joshua for all the Israelites to think of themselves as brothers and sisters and to see the past and the present and the future generations that way too.
How big is the family at that point? We're talking...
We're not talking thousands or tens of thousands. We're talking hundreds of thousands, if not millions.
Yeah, this is an extended family.
Yeah,
this
it
is a lot
stretches
bigger
than the mind.
Right,
you know.
Right.
But Zimmerman goes on to show how trustee families tended to begin a slow process of deterioration. In fact, through abuse of authority, through tribal feuding, and this sort of thing, you see alternative institutions beginning to emerge. What he says, the beginning signs of the state emerging alongside of the family, and he identifies this as the domestic family stage. And it's a transitional phase. It's also a traditional phase, whereas the family saw itself primarily in sacred and religious terms under the trustee arrangement. In the domestic phase, they see themselves more as a commercial unit in economic terms. And so they can sell the family property, even the land, if they can make a killing, if they can make a lot of money.
Yeah. And so it's all concentrated on the household and the nuclear family at that point?
Yes, it's moving towards the nuclear family. You still have a sense of extended kinship, mm-hmm. but the family has redefined itself now exclusively in terms of those of us who are alive.
Okay.
Mom, dad, the kids, the cousins, the aunts and the uncles, mm-hmm. but those of us who are alive now who want to make a profit. It's more commercial and economic, as I said. And you also see some other signs of change. Whereas marriage was a binding covenant that was practically indissoluble and sacred, mm-hmm. now it's seen as a contract, legally binding, but no longer sacred. And so divorce becomes permissible. It's still frowned upon, but it's a transitional and a traditionalist phase where morality is kind of severed from religious ritual, from worship and liturgy and
sure.
the hearth and so on.
Well, it's no longer serving a sacred end. Marriage is serving the economic unit.
That's right.
Right.
And whereas adultery had been a crime in trustee family civilizations, it's only seen as a sin, a kind of private sin. And so he recognizes this domestic family stage as transitional. It might last several generations, but there are certain inherent tendencies for it to break down even further as the state begins to grow bigger and stronger and assumes more and more family responsibilities, health, education, welfare, things that the trustee family always supplied. Now the state institutions emerge, beginning to supply them instead of the family, and the economy gradually supplants the family as well, leading Zimmerman into what he calls the third stage, the Adamistic phase.
And that's not Adam, A-D-A-M,
that's Adam. A-T-O-M, that's right. It's a kind of nuclear or atomic view of the family, whereas the family was a kind of mystical organism, a kind of a religious corporation before, then it lapses into a kind of economic unit. Here it's almost like a cocoon. Mm. It's something that you're born into but you can't wait to get out of, and you define freedom in terms of breaking free from these family constraints.
Right, right. And that would change the way you view everything, your relationship with your parents, because suddenly it's adversarial now.
It also changes the way you view your spouse as well. Mm-hmm. He points out while divorce was permitted for the first time in the domestic phase, it becomes rampant. No fault divorce, mm-hmm. in fact. He's writing this book in the late 1940s. He's not trying to, you know, prophesy anything, but what's so interesting is he identifies the characteristics of the atomistic family stage. He shows how sexual immorality is no longer just tolerated, it's rampant. Yes. How no-fault divorce becomes the norm. How population decline is mm-hmm. evident. He also shows generational conflict, not only abuse of children, but abuse by older children of their parents mm-hmm. as well. And he shows us how in parts of India, in China, in Rome, in Greece, and elsewhere, no civilization that moved from the trustee to the domestic down to the atomistic ever recovered. Right. It never was able to kind of retrieve its solidarity or its continuity with the past. It was invariably conquered by external foes or it just simply collapsed internally.
So it's a big jump for us. We're living in this atomistic stage right now, it
That's
seems,
right.
with the breakdown of what little we called the family. And we have, when we read the Bible, we have to completely change the way we look at family, it seems, because we're looking at a different reality when we see the trustee family there.
That's right. When we read the Old Testament, we read about the family of Israel, God's family, and mm-hmm. God as the Father.
Right.
But when we think of Israel as a family, it's really a metaphor. We must translate that in terms of, well, the families that made up the nation state of Israel,
yeah.
they were family, but the Israelites had the genealogies, they had the canonical narrative, they would have had the DNA proof to show that, yes, in fact, we are called Israel because we come from Israel. That
He's
is Abraham's right. grandson, yeah. Jacob, who had his name changed to Israel. His 12 sons raised 12 families, they became 12 tribes, they were brought out of Egypt at Mount Sinai, they became the 12 tribes of the national family of Israel. And again, it's a religious conception. It's very sacramental. Sexual immorality was not just a sin, but it was a crime according to the law of Moses, as it was in India and China, in Rome, in Greece, and many other trustee family civilizations that Zimmerman analyzes. I have another book here that I promised not to read by Carl van der Toorn entitled Family Religion in Babylonia, Syria, and Israel. And what we find in van der Toorn's research is a similar phenomenon in Babylonia and in Syria. That is, Israel's surrounding neighbors. These nations also understood themselves in religious terms, and they understood politics and economics, at least at some point early on in their history, as putting them in touch with the divine. And so marriage and family life was invested with something utterly sacred.
Well, this is interesting because this is the world that Jesus was born into.
That's right.
The world he grew up in.
The categories he assumed.
Right, right. So whenever we hear him using family language, which he always does, he's using these words in ways that we're not familiar with. We're not at home with.
Yes, they're right.
Yeah.
Good way to put it. Yeah. Father, mother, brother, sister, marriage, all of these terms, we immediately grasp them at one level, and then we almost have to translate them into a much higher level of solidarity and sacredness. And if we don't, our understanding of the New Testament ends up being superficial, and our understanding of the Old Testament will feel quite alien to us. It will really not feel at all like anything we've known
wow.
until we translate it back.
This makes a big difference, and I want to get back to that difference and how it'll change the way we read. Good. But right now we're out of time. Let's come back to that right after this.
Its goal is to give glory to God through the holiness of its members.
Each week, take a close-up look at ecclesial movements and the spiritual, missionary, and educational riches they bring to the heart of the church.
Our passion is youth evangelizing youth, and that's our goal.
Ecclesial Movements in the Universal Church with Father C. John McCloskey.
Everyone is called to holiness, not just the clergy or the religious, but the lay folk.
Only on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.
Welcome back to First Comes Love, our ongoing discussion of the family, the church, and the Trinity. Scott, last time we left off talking about the three different kinds of family, according to this analysis. There's the trustee family, the domestic family, and the atomistic family.
That's right.
Right? And How did this play out in ancient Israel? How did it develop? How do you see it in the Old Testament? How should we be seeing it in the Old Testament?
Well, when I finished Zimmerman and I went back and reread the Old Testament, mm-hmm. suddenly I started connecting lots of dots.
Yeah,
I began to understand not only what happened at Mount Sinai when they had a kind of constitutional convention making them more than just a nation, but a national family.
But they had already been related by blood.
That's right.
They
just renewed that after their centuries of bondage. Then they went into the Promised Land as an ancestral inheritance that had been promised by God to their forefathers generations ago. That kind of vision, though, makes so much sense in view of the sacredness of the land and also the religious role that we have in playing out the duties that we've received from our forefathers. But as you see them conquer the land, you see them become a kingdom, that is, a nation that rules other nations. You see Edom and Moab and others coming under Israelite authority. And the father, the founding father, Jacob Israel, had uttered a prophecy much earlier, way back in Genesis 49, that one of his sons, Judah, would produce royal seed. And so the lion of the tribe of Judah, David, mm-hmm. becomes the first king to establish a dynasty, so that we see this trusty family more than just a nation. We see it as a kind of imperial family, a national kingdom family.
But isn't there a danger there? They're starting to bring other people in. Are they part of the family now?
Well, there at Zion in Jerusalem, the temple was to be, as Jesus called it, my father's house. It was the house of the God of Israel, but is where Gentiles were to discover that the God of Israel is called to be their father too. Mm. But unfortunately, after Solomon, after David's son Solomon, and then after Solomon's demise, you see the move from the trustee family lapsing into the domestic family. Before I mentioned that the trustee family had patriarchy and matriarchy. So you see in 1 Kings, not only the son of David, Solomon, ruling, but there in 1 Kings 2:19, the matriarchal figure, the queen mother.
And the queen mother is always there throughout the history of,
right.
the Davidic kingship.
That's right. But as the Davidic kingdom is corrupted, as it lapses into idolatry, as it lapses into a kind of overvaluation of the purely economic and the commercial, you begin to see the disintegration. I mean, as soon as Solomon dies, there's a civil war. In 930 BC, 10 tribes revolt against the kingdom of Judah down south. They form this rebel coalition. These 10 tribes make themselves Israel up north. They're never reunited with the kingdom of Judah down south, and yet God has staked his covenant with Judah and the lion of the tribe of Judah.
Right.
So that by the time the Assyrians wiped out the 10 tribes in 722 BC, we have literally a domestic family nation there, because the 12 tribe confederation has disintegrated. Judah alone is really left.
And if you have that kind of rebellion, the trustee family is untenable.
That's right. In fact, Zimmerman points out that the abuse of patriarchal authority, what we often associate with patriarchalism or authoritarianism, is not the trustee, but the domestic phase, where the land is up for sale, values are up for grabs, everything is for me.
Daddy's the boss.
Daddy's the boss, that's right. And so it's an imperialistic, monarchical vision that really corrupts the family solidarity that unites them. Judah alone is left, and even they are punished by God by Babylon, which comes to destroy Jerusalem, the capital of Judah, in 586. For 70 years, the Jews are in captivity, but God has promised to bring them back. So around 535 BC, we have Judah coming back to Judea, and not with the 10 tribes, though. It's just Judah. That's why we call it the birth of Judaism. Around 530 BC, you have Jerusalem, Judea, the temple being gradually rebuilt. This is the religious context into which Jesus was born, of the tribe of Judah. Yeah, the opening chapter of the New Testament, Matthew 1, gives us Jesus' genealogy, tracing him through all the way back to Abraham through David, but he is in the tribe of Judah. And so he sees Judea as his own tribal territory. Once again, trusty family categories really help us to understand, you know, the clan or the extended kinship network that he would have grown up in there in Nazareth.
Sure. And they must have been trying to, since they were trying to reconstitute Israel.
Yes.
They were trying to recover this idea of a trustee family, it seems.
We're going to have to do another show or a series on this eventually, because, you know, it's so important to recognize that with the Maccabean revolt a couple centuries earlier and the Hasmonean dynasty and the Herodian temple being rebuilt, there were a lot of nationalist aspirations among the Jews and even the Israelites up north in Galilee who weren't Jewish but were Israelite. They were hoping that maybe God will make us a national, maybe an imperial family once again. But God had other plans. These plans unfold for us in the Gospels. And what I find so interesting is how ordinary stories that we've heard many times suddenly become three-dimensional. They come alive when we see them in trustee family terms. I'm thinking especially of the finding of the boy Jesus in the temple that Luke narrates for us in Luke chapter 2. You know, when we hear the story again and again, we're tempted to think that, you know, what were Mary and Joseph thinking? How could they have lost the boy and not known he was
gone? Their only child, right.
Yeah, their only child. And yet what we read in Luke 2, verse 42, when he was 12 years old, they went up according to custom to Jerusalem for the feast. And when the feast was ended, as they were returning, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. His parents did not know it. Why? Supposing him to be in the company, they went a day's journey, and they sought him among their kinsfolk and acquaintances, and when they didn't find him, they returned to Jerusalem seeking him.
And it takes a day pretty much to go through the kinsfolk.
That's exactly right. I mean, this was a family entourage. This could have been hundreds and arguably thousands of people who would have come down from Nazareth in Galilee for this Judean feast there in the Jerusalem temple. And it was a trustee family thing. It was religious, but it was familial. Religion was familistic, and family life was inescapably religious. And it's a challenge for us, I think, because we grew up in families, Catholic families here in Scripture, in the fathers of the church, and in Vatican II, that the family is a domestic church, just as the church is the family of God. That interplay back and forth isn't, you know, like mixing metaphors or confusing people. Yeah. It really recognizes, it's sort of like quartz.
Yeah.
Quartz has a certain crystalline structure. And if you break it apart, even the tiniest fragments retain that crystalline structure.
Yeah.
And so God's people, whether they're an empire or a nation, or whether they're just a clan, or Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, and the Holy Family, they retain this God-like divine image, the structure that reflects the Trinity, as we consider
because God time. Himself is a family.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah, we keep coming back to that God in His deepest mystery is not a solitude, but a family, because God has in Himself fatherhood, sonship, and the essence of the family, which is love.
You said something earlier I'd like to go back to, because I think it's an important distinction, especially in this day and age. You made the distinction between patriarchy, which is good, and patriarchalism, which is a mouthful, also which is not good. Can you clarify that a little bit? And why is this? Why are these ideas controversial today?
Yeah, I think that what we find in Zerman's analysis, and others too, he's not the only family sociologist who's discovered this sort of thing. You'll find it in the 19th century in Fustel de Coulanges and Sir Henry Maine and others. They recognized that prior to the kind of authoritarian structures of patriarchalistic families, you have a much more religious conception of the family that did have patriarchy, but it also had matriarchy. In fact, you can't have matriarchy without patriarchy, but if you have fatherhood, you have motherhood. And if you have both concepts exalted in the light of religious convictions and divine revelation, there and only there can you find what really makes marriage sacramental, what makes the marital covenant something of a reflection of the inner life of God. That's why outside of Israel, in these trustee family civilizations, you speak of the gods of the fathers, you know, and the land was sacred, the blood was sacred. In fact, the besetting sin of many of these trustee family civilizations was ancestor worship. They didn't just honor their elders, they venerated them excessively. That's not exactly a sin that we're tempted to commit these days. In so-called Christian countries, we tend toward the opposite extreme. We just tend to forget or neglect our parents as well as our grandparents and so on.
But there's a lot of kind of knee-jerk reaction against patriarchy these days. You know, they use it to dismiss hierarchy and that sort of thing. Where did that come from, do you think?
It comes from the abuse of the authority that is invested in the parents. It comes from the loss of the religious vision of the family. It comes from the move away from the trustee family to the domestic family, where people begin to see that economic profit, commercial exchange, my own personal gain, these are the premium that I place on living and decision making, that sort of thing. Once that happens, then you find in ancient Rome and Greece, India and China, child abandonment. You find easy divorce. You find a growing tolerance for sexual immorality. Adultery no longer strikes at the heart of the family, which is the sacred marriage. Mm-hmm. It's considered something of a personal preference. That shows us the total corruption of the sacred authority that God invests in husband and wife, mm-hmm. in father and mother. This is, and one last thought, you know, Zimmerman shows us that every single society that became a civilization started off as a trustee family, as it were. That no non-trustee family ever really becomes a civilization, but he also points out that no trustee family civilization remains intact in the 1940s, much less in our day and age. God the Father has seemingly allowed all of these trustee family civilizations to disintegrate.
This is where I was going. It's kind of scary because it's not like you can put the shampoo back in the bottle here.
Yeah, that's right, or toothpaste back into the tube.
Right.
I mean, you can't put it all back together again, but in this sense, we don't have to. Hmm. Because what God shows us is this, that God is up to a task of his own, trustee family. He is fathering his family. And this is what the new covenant brings about. The Father sends the Son to give us the Spirit so that all these trustee families that are disintegrating because of sin can be reunited in the body, blood, spirit of Jesus Christ.
So even this catastrophe of the breakdown of the family can have a happy ending.
That's right. That the Church of the New Covenant is the only trustee family that God will preserve till the end of time, and that's where we all find ourselves. We don't need to go back and reinvent the wheel, start our own trustee families. We have to find our place in God's trustee family.
That's reassuring. I didn't feel up to the task of recreating civilization.
Right.
Scott, I guess we have a lot to go over in the coming weeks. This is a great beginning we have here.
One of the things I want to do next time is to look at how Jesus advances the family and at the same time undermines it to show us the only way to the supernatural.
That sounds controversial, and I'm looking forward to it, and I look forward to getting together with you too. Join us then on First Comes Love.
There's much more to learn about the Catholic and biblical understanding of the family, the Church, and the Trinity. I invite you to join me again in the pages of my book, First Comes Love. There we can go deeper into the mysteries of the family, the Church, and the Trinity. I believe First Comes Love is my most important book, the foundation for everything else I've written. To learn more about the fatherhood of our early Christian ancestors, read Mike Aquilina's book, The Fathers of the Church, an excellent introduction to the first formative period of the Catholic faith.